Podcasting from Knoxville, along the banks of the mighty Tennessee River, this is the Startup Knox podcast featuring interviews with local entrepreneurs. I'm your host, Brandon Bruce, and today we continue our series of interviews in partnership with Webb School of Knoxville. Each student in the Introduction to Entrepreneurship and Design Thinking course and the Honors Entrepreneurship course interviews a local entrepreneur. In this episode, John Tolsma, class of 2023, interviews Ross Crowley.
Alrighty, well, welcome guys. Thank y'all for coming. This here is Mr. Ross Crowley. He is the founder and CEO of GSV. And obviously over the past few months, I've gotten to know you pretty well. But just tell us a little bit about yourself and what GSV is.
Sure. So GSV is basically, it's family office. So basically means we invest our own money. And we basically invest in software companies, typically not necessarily startups, but software companies that are growing, right? So they're probably 1 million, 2 million in revenue or up to 100 million in revenue. And we'll put money in those companies and try to help them grow and accelerate and hopefully be market leaders in the spaces that they're in. So it's kind of like private equity or venture capital, but instead of using other people's money, it's our dollars that go into that, which is the family office piece of what we do.
Very interesting. So obviously you've told me the way of how you got your start. It's a very interesting story. Would you like to elaborate and tell us how you got your start and how GSV came to be?
Sure. So when you think about private equity, venture capital, most people start in that space. They go to business school, usually they go to an Ivy League school. Like most people in that space who go to Harvard or Yale or Princeton, they become an investment banker and ultimately, they work at a private equity shop for 20 years and become a partner. And that's the path. My path was totally different. So I started when I was in high school, when I was 16 years old, I started my first company as an entrepreneur and I started with gumball machines. I was 16. I wanted to make extra money because I had a single mom and paying for gas for the car or car insurance or going out to eat with friends, you had to pay your way. So I put gumball machines all over Knoxville and I don't know where I came up with the idea. I think I was reading a magazine and something. I think it was probably an advertisement, but it said something to the effect of gumball machines. And I go, oh, that's a good idea. So I put them out and I was making $1,600 a month in quarters when I was 16 years old. And so that kind of started the entrepreneurial bug. When I was 19, I decided, I was going to go to college and I had to pay my way through school because again, I didn't have all the, I went to public school first of all. So going to public school, it's kind of eat or be eaten, pay your way through school. And so I was working a part-time job. While I was working there, they said, hey, if anybody could do a website, we'd love to have that. Well, this was in 1997 when no one knew what the internet was, but I just kind of jumped at that. I didn't really know how to build a website, but I knew kids from school that were like computer kids. I don't know if that's a thing, but it wasn't my day. And so I said, look, I'll start the business. You help me build the websites. And that was the beginning of a business. And I was 19. And so that business, when you start and you start with nothing, you use credit cards to fund your business, right? Because you got to buy computers and you have to buy, somebody said, oh, you have to have a server. I didn't even know what that was, but we had to have one. So next thing you know, you're $18,000 in credit card debt when you're 19 years old. And you realize, oh my gosh, I can't quit because if I quit, I have to pay all this money back. So now you got to, it gets real, so you have to work at it. So for many years, I made a lot of cold calls, getting a phone book out, dialing for dollars, basically, trying to sell websites to anyone I could. Over the years, I realized that trying to be everything to everybody didn't really work. And what you needed to do was specialize and focus. And so we started focusing on specific types of organizations. Originally, it was schools, hospitals, banks. And we said if we could build technology that was specific to them, we could scale it better, make it a bigger company. And so I guess, started in 97. It was what I would call a 15-year overnight success story, 15 years of hard knocks, 15 years of standing by that mailbox waiting for checks to come in to make payroll, 15 years of going to the bank to borrow money and learning that banks don't want to lend to people who don't have money. They want to lend to people who have money. And so there's very few good bankers that actually will lend to people that need it, right? So I learned a lot of, I would call school of hard knocks lessons, but that business grew over the years. And as I became very specialized in specific verticals, eventually it turned into a really big business. And that business, I ultimately sold it to a private equity firm for about $1.4 billion after 15 years into the business. So I guess by the time I hit my mid-30s, I'd kind of gone from startup at 19 where I had nothing to, oh my gosh, what do? I feel like I won the lottery, right? So at that point, you kind of look at it and say, you've made this money. I can either give it to a money manager, and then that when you go meet with them, they'll tell you, well, you know, you can make 5 to 10% money if everything goes great, or you could lose 30% if it all goes bad, or we could take what we knew how to do and just keep replicating it. And so that was our path. We looked at it, and this is a couple of my business partners, and we said, what built our business and turned it into this great business, we felt like we had a system, a program, kind of a playbook. And we said, what if we could replicate that playbook across other software companies across various verticals? And so ultimately, that's what we did. And that's how we created Greater Sum Ventures. We pooled our money together and we said, we want to help other entrepreneurs. We understood how to go from zero to billion-dollar company. How do we do this multiple times over? And so we created GSV, and I think we created from there 7 more companies that became billion-dollar plus software companies from that. So that's the short version.
Mm-hmm. Obviously, I've gotten to meet some of your partners over the past months. How important is it to have business partners that you trust in your business life?
Yeah, I think it starts with having great mentors, mm-hmm. to be honest, because when I started out, you know, again, with a single parent, I had a great relationship with my dad. He was an entrepreneur, but they didn't live together. They lived in 2 different states. And so I was constantly looking for mentors who could help me. And for me, mentors were people that had done it before, right? Because what I learned, and maybe I'm cynical about it a little bit, but when I went to school, everything in the school I went to, they didn't have entrepreneurship class, right? They had learned how to go be an employee and work somewhere. But I didn't feel like, as I went to college and I went to my first job interview in college and they told me the starting salary, I couldn't live on that. And so for me, building a business was kind of like the path to getting out of what I felt. There's always somebody poorer than you, right? But I didn't feel like we had a lot when I was growing up. So when you see that and then you go to the job interview and they tell you your starting salary and you go, oh my gosh, I could never live on this, right? Then you realize I'm going to have to make it on my own. So you look for mentors who've done it before, who have success. I mean, the thing that I realized when I was younger is when you would leave school and you drive down the street, you see all these buildings. Somebody owns that building. Somebody owns that business in that building. Everywhere you look, there's an entrepreneur. And so I realized early on, I don't want to be the guy who works in the building. I want to be the guy who owns the building. And how do I do that? I've got to meet the people that do it. And so developing mentors were important to me. I read a lot of books about successful entrepreneurs. So I read a lot about the robber barons. John Rockefeller was actually, I built one of my companies based on his model of Standard Oil. And so that was kind of, I think that starts with mentors, to be honest. Business partners, I would tell you, I've had various experiences with business partners. It's always important to have controls. Yes. Don't have a 50-50 partnership. Mm-hmm. I learned that the hard way early on. That's tough. So for me, I have business partners, but I always stayed in control. That was important.
Mm-hmm. Moving on to the lessons that you've learned in the business over the years, what's the most important lesson you've learned as an entrepreneur?
Perseverance. The hardest thing in business is that every day is not an easy day. And many, many, many days, you don't get the client you thought you would, or don't get the customer you thought you would, or the money doesn't show up. I can tell you some of my hardest days ever. I mean, in the early days, you had to make payroll every 2 weeks, right? So you hire all these employees and you have these aspirations and dreams of building this great business. And then you go sell customers and they owe you money. And this is one thing you'll learn early is that it's not just about selling, it's about collecting the money. So I had payroll was due every other Friday. And every other Friday, that payroll could have been $100,000. And I might start on a Monday with $100 in your bank account. And so from Monday to Friday, you have to find $100,000. And so you'll stand by the mailbox and you'll wait for the mailman to come and you'll check. And then when you open the check and it's $200, you get nervous. Mm-hmm. So you start dialing all your customers and you tell them, I'm going to drive and come see you. I'm in Charlotte today. You weren't really, but you're going to be because you're going to pick up that check they owe you. So those are To me, we always said, you don't quit, right? So every day, if you can fight to make it to the next day, something new will happen and change, and you'd be amazed at what could change in a day. But if you tried to plan when you were struggling, if you tried to plan 3 months out, you couldn't mentally picture it because that day was so hard. So you would have to break your day into 30-minute cycles, hour cycles, and say, how do I get through the next 30 minutes? How do I get to the next hour? And if you can make that, then, you know, you'd survive. And so the key was don't quit.
Kind of going back to those hard days, do you have one day that sticks out in your business journey that was the most difficult day of being an entrepreneur?
I can tell you, when you're 19, 20 years old, 21 years old, and you didn't have entrepreneurship class, and you didn't really know much about business, and you don't file all your tax paperwork correctly, mm-hmm. and the tax man shows up, that's a bad day.
That is a tough
day. And I've had those days, early days. I don't have any days like that now, but I did. And I'll tell you, when the IRS agent comes in and tells you, here's what payroll taxes mean, and you owe a bunch of them, that's a terrible day. And then you realize that at the end of the day, what they want is to get paid. They don't want you to go out of business. And so you start, and you realize this early in business with banks too, right? If you get to the position where you can't pay them, the better thing to do is work out a payment plan and stick to it and do what you say you're going to do, and they'll work with you, right? And that's what I learned early days with not only the tax man, the bankers. I mean, I remember I had a line of credit early days, right? So when I started in 97, you had the lead up to the dot-com bubble. So everything was booming. 99, everybody's going crazy. People loaning money. You're doing great business. And then in 2000, the market crashes and your business goes the opposite direction. So we had taken out a loan from a bank and we thought, you know, it was the greatest thing ever. And then all of a sudden business went backwards. And the bank called and, you know, they weren't happy. And I remember thinking, oh my gosh, are they going to put me out of business? They're going to call my loan. And I went to one of these mentors and I said, what do I do? And he gave me the best advice ever because he said, Ross, they don't want a non-performing loan. So they're not going to call your loan. You need to go sit with them and say, I know the payment is this, but I can't pay that, but I can pay this and make them restructure it. He said, because it's better for them to restructure than it is for them to have a non-performing loan. So I learned a lot then that I had more leverage than I thought I did. And so we restructured and it kept going. So this goes back to you keep going, you don't quit, but definitely the tax man was always a bad day.
Oh yeah. Kind of going to that perseverance. Do you have a favorite day in your entrepreneurship journey that you were like, all right, this is a good one?
When I sold the business for $1 billion, that was a good day.
Mm-hmm.
That put a big smile on my face. Mm-hmm. It was a hard day because I actually thought I lost the deal because leading into it, we actually, a couple things in the business hadn't performed exactly how we thought they would. And I felt like the deal was about to fall apart. And I had 24 hours to basically make my pitch back to them of why it was what they thought it was. And it came down to literally, I mean, it was almost like a movie. I mean, it came down to like one phone call for 30 minutes from 5 o'clock to 5:30. And we spent all day preparing like four slides or five slides of like why it's better than you think it is. And we figured out a way to really present it differently than they had been looking at it. And we did that. We did it on a conference call. There was no Zoom then. And these guys were in New York. We were in Knoxville. And I remember we made the best pitch we could, hung up the phone. And it was like 10 minutes later, a guy calls back and says, okay, we're done. We'll do the deal. And I just remember I about collapsed in the parking lot when he called because I thought I left it all out in the field. Like there's nothing left, you know? Mm-hmm. So that was a good day.
That sounds like a great day. I know we've talked about this question at your house for some time. What is your favorite part of being an entrepreneur and why do you love it so much?
So for me, I think it's the fact that I got into entrepreneurship because I had to pay my bills. Mm-hmm. I had to pay my way through life, right? And so a lot of entrepreneurs start businesses for various reasons. They start them because they have a hobby, they like what they're doing, they get, you know, it turns into a business. I started it to better my life situation. And the thing that drew me to entrepreneurship was that you had unlimited upside, right? So I knew if I worked a job, it was go take the job, here's what they're gonna pay me. Every year it's kind of, do they have to pay me 5% more? Do they pay me 3% more? Do they pay me 10% more? Because every year they maybe factor in a raise. I knew as an entrepreneur, if I was good at what I did and I really worked on it, the sky was the limit. There was no one who was going to cap what you could do. It's just how big could you dream? How hard could you work? How many things would go right in your world. So for me, it was unlimited upside potential. And then there's other benefits that came with it. The more success you had, the more you set your own schedule and the more you could do what you wanted, right? But in the early days, I probably had less vacation time and less free time than anybody. I mean, I know my wife would look at me and say, why are you still working at 8 o'clock at night? Why are you working at 10, 11 o'clock at night? And I'd say, because if I don't do it, no one will, and I have to pay the bills tomorrow. You know, so those were things that I had to worry about in the early days. And fortunately, I don't worry about that now, but I did then.
Yeah. So Mr. Ross, if there's one skill students like us should learn, what do you think it would be?
Yeah, so I had a mentor early on tell me this, and it's always stuck with me, and it was, you have to have the want to. I didn't go to Ivy League school. I didn't finish college. I didn't do all the extracurricular. I played basketball, but I didn't do all the extracurriculars that most kids do. I see a lot of kids get a lot of pressure to do everything, to try to be perfect, to go to the perfect school, to get the perfect career. What I had was the want to. And so for me, the want to is the difference.
Yeah, that's great. And kind of going back to those days when you were younger in high school, when you were our age, what did you think you would be doing as a career later in life?
So it started out, like I said, when you're poor, and I wasn't poor. There's people, I hate to say that, because there's people definitely worse conditions. But you start hearing career advice, and it's always like, be a doctor, be a lawyer. I couldn't be a doctor because I could never look at the gore and the blood, and I just can't do that. But so then it was, well, be a lawyer, right? Because the perception is a lawyer, you're going to do well, you provide for your family, et cetera. I learned early on that like being a lawyer for me would have been too much reading and too much writing and too much. And I thought I was going to be a lawyer. I actually told my wife, I said, I'm going to be a lawyer. And I think she, you know, we started dating in high school, eventually got married after college. I think she probably thought I was going to be a lawyer. But eventually over time, you realize that that wasn't the right calling. And by circumstance, I ended up an entrepreneur because I was, like I said, trying to just make a living. Mm-hmm. And, you know, once you got into it, you couldn't get out of it. So then you just had to make it better and better and better. And I wouldn't change it now for anything. But at the time, I thought I was going to be a lawyer.
Mm-hmm. So, Mr. Ross, I know sometimes when I'm at your house, you're always busy making deals and stuff. What's it, like the day-to-day life like in the venture capital world?
Sure. So it's kind of like a big version of Shark Tank a little bit. So we are always looking. We probably look at 1,000 companies a year at deals that we evaluate. And so we have a whole team of people that all they do is call software companies, they email them, they meet them at conferences, they generate what we call deal flow, that ultimately we get to look at entrepreneurs who've built a business, who've gotten some level of traction or success that need additional capital. They either need it for growth, they need it because a lot of entrepreneurs, all of their net worth is tied up in the value of their business. So they have this great business, and on paper, they've made a lot of money, but in reality, they don't make that much money, right? And so the only way they get that value is to sell part of their company to somebody for a large value, and then get some of that liquidity for all the work that they did. So we're constantly looking for those companies. We get the information on those companies, and we evaluate them. So we're solving for us, we want to put money in a deal where we can make 3 times our capital over 5 years. Right. So it's basically a little over a 20% annualized return. So if you look at the stock market, maybe you make 10%, 12%, things go great. We want to make 20%+. Now, in reality, we've been fortunate. We average about 4 times our money in 24 months. And I think it's because we do a really good job of finding great opportunities, helping those businesses accelerate. And we say no to a lot of deals that don't look like the right things. So I think that's part of it.
Yeah. You know, being in the venture capital game, there's a lot of names from a lot of big cities and stuff. Why is Knoxville so important to GSV?
So this is where we were started, right? I started here. So it's funny because I thought when I started originally, you know, we opened an office at one point in New York. You know, we're trying to expand our business, software company, early days. And I remember having the office in New York, and it was such a struggle because I would go up there, and this perception is you got to get to New York. You don't make it until you're in New York and you can do business in New York. And so I remember walking the streets of New York, and I'd walk past these buildings, and I could never get in the buildings because I was calling to get appointments to like sell our software to these companies, and nobody would take them. And so it was the hardest office I ever had. And so eventually I finally closed the office because I realized like it's just too hard up here. when I stopped worrying about being in New York and just focused on running my business here and building a great software business, you know what happened? All the investors from New York came to me. Mm-hmm. And so to me, it proved that I didn't have to be outside of Knoxville. I could do it here. What mattered was that I built great businesses that had great, like the one thing that I didn't know when I was an entrepreneur, I wish I had known early. And this is something as a younger person who's thinking about starting a business, you should start a business that has what they call a big total addressable market, like a big TAM. So when I started, I didn't understand that term. I'd never heard it. So, you know, you read all these stories and you hear like people on Shark Tank or anywhere and they say, I start a business and then I want to go raise money. Well, if your TAM isn't big enough, you can't raise money. And what that means is if I had sold my products to everybody that could possibly buy my products, is that market a $500 million market? Is it a $10 million market? Is it a $1 billion plus market? What I learned was that building businesses with a TAM that had a $1 billion plus market opportunity, meaning if I sold everybody that could buy my product, that was a customer, my product, it was worth $1 billion or more, that was a large TAM. That gave me opportunities to then be able to get investors in. So this is the number one lesson I wish I had learned early was, don't start a business with a small TAM, because ultimately everybody exits their business at some point, right? They exit it because they quit. They exit it because it goes out of business. They exit it because they sell it. They exit it because they give it to someone else. But ultimately you won't be in it forever. Your better opportunities for exits will come by having a larger TAM. If you start a lemonade stand on the side of the street, it's a tougher business, right? If you start a Smoothie King, it's got more TAM. So those are simple concept that I never understood.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. During this interview, Mr. Ross, you've talked a lot about the importance of mentorship. Where did you find your mentors, and what do you think is the best way of approaching that?
So honestly, what you'll find is most successful entrepreneurs want to tell their story, and most successful entrepreneurs want to help other people learn how to do it. And so what I learned was that if I just called on people that were successful, or I got an introduction through somebody, or it was a family friend, you realize like most people that have tremendous amounts of success want to tell that, and they actually eventually feel guilty about their success a little bit, and then they say, well, how do I help other people have success? Because why was I the one that had this, right? So you find that most entrepreneurs want to tell their stories. It's the reason why, if you look, there's so many autobiographies of great entrepreneurs, because they have all the success and they're like, man, I got to tell people what happened. Mm-hmm. Like this was a crazy outcome for me. I mean, I loved reading, like Richard Branson's a great entrepreneur. I read a lot of his books. You know, I read, like I said, about Rockefeller, Carnegie, Morgan, but, there's a lot of books on it as well.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Kind of going back to that persistence, in the business world, would you say there's a point where your persistence kind of pays off? And if so, like, how do you know that point is there?
Again, I just come back to you. The persistence is most people quit. Mm-hmm. Most people, when you read the statistic that most businesses fail 90% of the time, I'd say there's a couple reasons why they fail. Number one, I've heard the saying, if I make a great product, the money will take care of itself. That's not true. Take care of the money. If you don't take care of the money, it won't take care of itself. You'll lose the money. And so the number one thing I would say is have a good business model, first of all. Recurring revenue is way easier than one-time sales. So example, if I sold telephones, right, I get a one-time fee for selling you the phone. But if I sold the phone service, as long as I don't lose you from paying the monthly fee, every time I add a new customer, I grow easier. So I think that's a key component is your business model matters. I think that the persistence is, I think it's the key to everything. I mean, most people fail, like I said, because they quit early, times get tough, and they just throw in the towel. Instead of, you have to be creative. As an entrepreneur, you have to creatively solve the problem on a daily basis. Nobody solves it for you. So if you don't have money, you got to get creative. Maybe you got to pledge your house. Maybe you got to pledge a car. Maybe you got to go to a family and friend. You do everything possible to survive, because you know you make it one more day, something could change. You might sign that big new customer that you didn't think you were going to get. So I just learned. And here's the thing. I never wanted to quit, because quitting meant I had to pay back all the money I owed. And that wasn't a good option. And the other side is that I never raised money from people until I actually sold part of my business, because I always felt like if I raised money, I had to pay it back, right? So if I knew I was going to pay it back, the most expensive capital I could get was from an investor, because the investor not only wants his money back, but he wants a high level of return on top of it. Whereas a bank, at least I knew with a bank, I have to pay them back, but there's a set interest rate, right? They're not charging me the same amount. So for me, I feel like it comes back to failure wasn't an option, because if I ever took someone else's money, I'd know I have to pay it back. Mm-hmm. And if I borrowed money from a bank, I'd know I have to pay it back. So you can't quit. Mm-hmm. Once you start, you got to go.
Mm-hmm. Well, I think before I open it up for questions, is there any last things? I know I've kind of already asked this question, if you had any advice, but do you have anything to say to us just to keep to promote us and going on in life? And
I'd say start early, right? Because I was fortunate enough to start a business when I was 19. So when I made a lot of mistakes, which I made a lot, it's easier to fail when you're young. Most people that start businesses early have time to correct and survive. If you were starting a business when you're in your 40s for the first time, and you have a family and kids and all these responsibilities, you're probably scared to start the business, because ultimately, if things don't go well, it's like it just rips the carpet out from under you. So I was fortunate enough out of circumstance to start when I was young enough to where if I failed, realistically, I would have survived in life. I didn't feel like I would, so I couldn't think of failure as an option. But I would say start early, because it won't go smoothly at first. You'll learn so much. I remember my first mentor, he's still a very good friend of mine. When I first met him, he said, "You don't know anything." He said, "I don't even know where to start, because you know nothing." He said, "You're starting from zero." And he was right. And so the only way you learn some of it is trial by fire. And, you know, start early enough. When the fire gets hot and you get burned a little bit, you're still young enough to recover.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Well, Mr. Ross, thank you so much for answering all of my questions. Do you guys have any questions for Mr. Ross before we wrap things up? Do we?
What makes a company attractive?
Yeah, so a couple things. They have to have a big TAM, right? So because as an investor, whatever money we're investing at, you have to be able to get 3 to 5 times bigger, maybe 6 times bigger in the end for there to be enough runway for the investor to put the money in. A revenue model, that's critical, right? Because we have to believe that when we're going to put the money in, that it doesn't require you to send salespeople out to sell every single month and beat last year's sales by selling 10% or 20% more. So if you have a revenue model where most of it's recurring, then all I have to believe is that your recurring stays and you add on top of it. If it's every day you got to go out and sell something new, and then next year you got to be 10% better or 20% better, that's hard to remember. So every investor is solving for how do they get their money back. And they're ultimately solving for most private equity and venture capital investors are solving for the same thing, which is 20 to 30% returns of capital on an annualized basis over a 5-year period. So they're going to look at your numbers today and they're going to say, where you're at now, how believable is it 5 years from now that you're 3 to 5 times bigger than you are now? How much can I believe that's true? And the easier it is to believe that's true, the easier it is to get the money from the investor.
What kind of software did you guys sell?
Yeah, so originally I sold software to colleges, banks, credit unions, eventually nonprofits, churches, schools. And pivoted into, I have software for property managers, behavioral health in the practice management software. I sold software to governments. So if you pay taxes for anything, like your tag renewal, driver's license, anything, we collected fees on that through the government software. We did software in the pet space. So there's a pet app now called Pet Desk that we own part of that company. We love payments. So anything that processes a credit card, we love that space. So we have a lot of payments companies. We have one just announced yesterday that it's a $1 billion value company now called Stax Payments. We invested in it a year ago when it was about a $200 million business. So in a year, it went from 200 million to a billion. So that was a pretty exciting opportunity. But I've been in most vertical software spaces I probably have an investment or have been invested in.
Any other questions? Mr. Bruce?
That's a great question. So, Ross, obviously, you're still super excited about what you're doing. Like you said, you've invested in so many industries where you've looked at deals in industries. I don't know that you would necessarily share it in a public forum, but are there particular industries that are exciting to you, even future-looking stuff that you haven't been involved in before?
I mean, that's a great question. We look every day. So we have a research team on in our group that all they do is look for industries that are growing. We always say that finding a space that has a rising tide raises all boats, right? So the reason we like payments in particular was that we felt like the society is moving from having cash in the wallet and checks to cashless. And so we felt like anything that moves to that cashless society is really, we want to be there. Because if you ask anybody in this room, there's probably very few that have very much cash on their body right now. And 10 years ago, that was different, right? And so that would be a space that we've always liked. We like healthcare. I mean, healthcare IT has been super exciting. I mean, even today when you go to the doctor's office, how many times you have to fill out the same papers over and over again? And every time you go, it's like, could you please fill out the paper deck here that's 10 pages long? And you think, I've done it 10 times. Like, do you ever just put it in the computer and save it? Like, I can't do it on an app. I don't understand. So those are the types of things that we like. Like, when you see inefficient processes, I mean, even like field services, you see plumbers, you know, they show up and they've got a pad of paper and write the ticket and sign it. I mean, all that should be on an app, and a lot of them are now. But, you know, we like we're in the automotive space, right? We like the repair shop service lane stuff. So about everything's being touched by technology, and we like software a lot.
So you mentioned cashless. There's a lot of interest in my classes. It's come up in all three classes this semester. Hey, let's talk more about crypto.
Yeah.
Let's talk about Bitcoin or Ether. And then when I was doing a junior achievement class, there was like a fourth grader who said, hey, if your lemonade stand was successful, what would you do with the proceeds? And the lesson was all about, well, you could give it to charity. You could reinvest in the business. You could take it out and save it.
Yeah.
You could invest it. And he raised his hand and said, I think I might invest some. And so the question was, what might you invest in? He said, I've been dabbling a little in Bitcoin, right? So this is like a fourth grader that's already in it. So is that a space that you all find interesting, or what's your
So the fact that you just gave that example makes my point. I view that as a bubble and a Ponzi scheme a little bit, because when you have fourth graders talking about investing in something that it's not a company, it doesn't produce anything, it's a mathematical equation that's been solved that people are valuing the answer to. I'm not saying it doesn't have value, but it only has value because other people think it has value. And the minute that somebody else decides it doesn't have value and you see the price fluctuations up and down, I mean, maybe owning the exchange would be valuable, but owning the coins themselves, like I've never got my mind around that. And like when I talk to people that do it, and listen, somebody else is going to make tons of money in this, but it's just when I talk to people who do it and their whole goal is to like wait till the Bitcoin gets to a certain size and then I'm going to cash it in and get cash. And I think, Isn't that the point? Like if you have to exchange your Bitcoin to get cash in order to like really feel the value of the Bitcoin, I don't like it's kind of backwards a little bit for me. So I'm not a crypto investor. I never have been. My brother-in-law does it, and I've kind of chastised him about it a little bit. I watch it and I say, man, you used to be worth this. Now you've dropped 40%. Like, I don't know. It just moves too much for me. But again, like I said, some people have done really well with it. I don't, it's not my thing.
So you mentioned a range of businesses, including like property management. So pandemic happens, a lot fewer people moving around, traveling, staying, vacation rentals, apartments, condos, et cetera. So for that business, for all of the businesses in the portfolio, how did you all adapt in 2020, 2021?
So we had some businesses that actually thrived even more, right? So we have some businesses, if you think about our payment processing, a lot of our payment processing went up. If you think about, like, we had a business that did virtual events. Well, it exploded. I mean, virtual events took off, but regular events software went down. So in some of our businesses, you'd see, because, again, our investing philosophy has been, if we invest in one software company, we do a lot of mergers and acquisitions. So a typical investment that we make ends up buying 5 to 7 companies to add on to it in a 12-month period. So a lot of our companies, when I talk about a company, it's really a collection in that platform of 20 companies. So what happens is if one or two of those is doing poorly, a lot of times six or seven of them are doing better. And so what we found is our portfolio actually thrived. We had a couple companies that were a little flat, maybe 5% growth when they used to be 15. But we had some companies that grew 30, 40, 50% during the pandemic. And what we found was selling assets in the pandemic was really good. Like so if you look at monetary policy right now, interest rates are super low. And what that really means is for everybody whose families invest, who have pension funds or they have 401ks or retirement funds, those fund managers can't get enough yield to pay the retirement obligations. So they've given more money to private equity investors to try to get bigger returns. Well, those guys now have so much money, they have to buy companies. And during the pandemic, there was a short, there's more money chasing companies to buy than there are companies to buy. So the valuations of businesses have gone through the roof. So for us during the pandemic, we actually did really well because of that. Sorry, I'm trying to get too technical. I feel like I could make this overly uninteresting. So,
no, you're good, Mr. Ross. Do any of y'all have any other questions before we wrap things up? No? Well, thank you guys so much for listening, Mr. Ross. Thank you so much.
Thank you.
Thanks for listening to the Startup Knox podcast. Join us for our next episode in partnership with Webb School of Knoxville. Each student in the Introduction to Entrepreneurship and Design Thinking course and the Honors Entrepreneurship course interviews a local entrepreneur. You can subscribe to the Startup Knox podcast, and you can download a free resource guide for entrepreneurs at startupknox.com. Thanks for listening.